Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to a NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part 2.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, the worldwide leader in officiating controversies.
I'm Sean McAnoo from The Athletic.
And you're in Puck Soup, the NBA going off the rails last night with the officiating. But honestly, a good segue to kick off the show. By the way, no Ryan this week. He's on vacation.
Yeah, he quit.
He said
he quit after what happened on the Patreon episode.
First of all, why would he? He apparently has the second best team, which I don't fucking understand. Apparently, nobody believes that you need a blue line in this league to win anymore, despite the presence of Victor Hedman and Shea Theodore and Miro Heiskanen in the Final Four. But he finished second in the Hockey Chopped episode. And once again, when it comes to building teams, somebody on this very podcast seems to be in line to become the next general manager of the Arizona Coyotes, because Sean wins every fucking time we do one of these episodes.
I mean, I feel like saying that I won is underselling it. There were 663 votes cast.
Uh-huh.
And I had 490. Ryan had 115.
Right.
And
I have
you
three.
Had the rest.
Right. No, cause I predicted this when we did the show. Like, one, I believe you are the
I
most popular
I too often predict that the best
host.
Team is going to win. That
No. I mean, listen, your team is great. You did really well. But there were three reasons why you won that episode. One, because you are the most well-liked host of the show. I think that's pretty apparent. Two, you drafted the most famous players. And so, you know, while the construction of my team was meticulous, it certainly doesn't have it. You had Pasternak and Bergeron, right? And Barkov, was it?
Yes.
That's crazy. And then three, I correctly predicted that you'd win because people were going to give you their vote for the absolute fucking assassin-like savagery that you showed on that bonus episode of cock-blocking Lambert from drafting Matt Barzal by sticking him with a rookie goalie contract.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it was incredible. It was an incredible moment. Episode's available on the Patreon if you want to listen to it. It was one of our most ingenious and best bonus episodes, that's for sure. No, Ryan says he's on vacation, which I believe is code word for he was on that plane of Antifa thugs that Trump was talking about the other day. So,
yeah,
you know,
clearly.
Good luck with that. Yeah. Antifa plane, the little scene sequel to Soul Plane. But as this episode of Soup Biscuits begins, we will begin with what we normally begin with, which is breaking news out of the National Basketball Association. Sean, Steve Nash is now the head coach of my Brooklyn Nets.
Yeah.
How about that?
That's interesting.
I'm excited.
We're going to miss Ryan on this segment because Ryan's usually like my basketball translator. I'm not an NBA guy. But am I wrong? Like, has Steve Nash coached anywhere?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Here's what I know about Steve Nash. Hall of Famer, okay? Canadian, okay? May actually be the doppelganger of J.E. Skeets, our good friend from the Yahoo days. They look the same. They might be the same person. Floppy hair. Always had the floppy hair. That was always a thing. Like he had that sort of silken floppy hair that, like, skater boys have is what he had. And, you know, he's the coach of the team now. And so here's the reason I wanted to bring it up. In the pantheon of Canadian athletes playing for American teams in American leagues, is he above Larry Walker, or is he like, what's the pecking order in the pantheon of that type of athlete that played in like MLB, NBA, or the NFL, if there had been any?
We don't really have a ton. Like, NFL, there have been a few guys that had like Canadian connections. Like,
right.
I feel like Mark Rippon was like, but it always ends up being like they moved to Montreal for a year in like
right.
middle school, and then I think it's
I would say mostly the NFL is like they had CFL ties at one point, like Warren
or that, yeah,
right,
yeah, exactly. Like, you know, Doug Flutie, Jeff Garcia, those guys are like honorary right. Canadians, but not actual Canadians. it's I mean, it would mainly be baseball. Basketball, like, it's kind of like right now you're seeing the wave. Like, Steve Nash was I don't want to say the first, because again, I don't really follow basketball, and someone's gonna like
the first like me, superstar, probably.
He was the first guy winning like MVP awards and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then baseball, it's yeah, I mean, Larry Walker, but he played half his career in Montreal. So
Montreal, right.
You do get it's that. Different. It's Ferguson Jenkins would be a big one.
Right.
And
right.
There's Joey Votto now, who's
yeah.
up there, and there have been a few guys, but yeah, I would say it's Nash, Jenkins. I don't know if you put Larry Walker on,
you know,
there just because he played Canadian, but he's definitely in terms of like on non hockey sports, Walker's on the pantheon.
There were a number of Expos and Blue Jays who I just assume probably were Canadian when I was a kid. Like,
yeah.
Like, there's no reason why Kelly... Yeah, there's no reason why Kelly Gruber shouldn't have been Canadian. Like,
well,
that's a Canadian-ass name.
Yeah, but
he seemed Canadian.
No, but then he opened his mouth and talked for 3 seconds, and it was... he was very not Canadian. That dude... He was a Southern dude, for sure.
Let me continue my list of Canadian yeah. Baseball players that I thought should be Canadian.
Okay.
Dave Steeb. Dave Steeb sounded very Canadian to me.
Yep.
No reason why he shouldn't have been. Hubie Brooks. Hubie was not a name that you normally would find in the United States. Always assumed that he was Canadian.
Okay.
Pascal Perez. I mean, I don't know how that would have worked, but I always assumed that he was probably Canadian. Maybe because of like Pascal yep. being very sort of French adjacent. These
sure.
were all people that I really thought were Canadian. Delino DeShields. Probably Canadian in my mind.
Probably.
But he wasn't.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all.
So,
the only Canadians that like played in Canada was like Larry Walker, Rob mm-hmm. Ducey, and
yeah.
like one of the Butler brothers, like the little 5'3"
right.
infielder dude. And I think that
Brent Smith, master of the palm ball, always assumed he was Canadian because he had a big Yukon Jack kind of beard when he played for the Expos. So
yeah, I could buy that.
Yeah. So I'm excited. This is an important connection between me and your country, is to have Steve Nash coaching the Nets.
For
so that's
3 months.
Also, should
yeah. Well, it's good because I'm always hearing about how complicated and strategic basketball is, and how I just don't understand it. And it's good to know that you need exactly zero experience coaching it to just step into an NBA job. That's like, what's the
correct.
Hockey equivalent of this? Like, what would? Because Nash ever play for the Nets?
No.
Yeah, okay.
So. No, he didn't. So would it be Gretzky? But I mean, that was sort of different because he was like an owner of the Coyotes.
Yeah, that was, yeah, Gretzky, I guess, would be the equivalent, because Patrick Waugh had coached in junior, and other guys who stepped into coaching did get in there. This would be more like the, you know, some, forgive me, struggle. This would be like the Sabres hiring...
Here's one.
Peter Forsberg to be the coach out of nowhere,
yeah,
and you're just all right.
This guy wasn't, like, I don't think on a Steve Nash level, obviously, because he was the Hall of Famer, but Eddie Olczyk becoming a coach in Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
But he played there, too. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's a hockey proxy. I will say this finally about Steve Nash. First coach in Nets history to have been name-checked in Nelly Furtado's song Promiscuous. Which I think is also a very impressive
feat. I need to fact check that. I'm not sure.
No, I could tell you that he was, but I don't know. I mean, it's possible that, like, you know, at some point another Nets coach had
that's
been,
it.
I guess,
I
right?
You know,
Chuck Daly was, you know, maybe name checked in one of those Nelly Furtado songs.
Probably was.
All right, back on hockey, because that's what you came here for, I assume. Playoffs are ongoing, as per usual. By the time you hear this podcast, shit'll have happened, and everything we said is invalid. Although probably not at the level of last week when we lambasted the entirety of the NHLPA for their inaction on racial injustice, and then the next day they canceled 2 days of games.
Right.
We'll get to that later. Columbus and thank you. Colorado and Dallas. I put a COL. I'm like fucking Friedman over here with the thinking it's a bad abbreviation. Colorado and Dallas played their game last night. It's going to go 7. Dallas is blowing this thing. It's looking very much like last season. They lose game 6 and then game 7 in double overtime to St. Louis last year. They lose game 6 this year. Same score, by the way. That's creepy, 4-1. And now we go to a game 7. This is a really tough one because I think as this goes, and if Dallas does lose, the Ben Bishop situation is going to be one of those hockey lore moments.
Yep.
Of the decision
it's,
to play him.
It's going to feel a lot like the Grady Little doesn't take Pedro out of the game moment. Yes. Where it's not, you know, it didn't decide the whole game, but it's going to start to feel like that.
There's something to be said karmically about what they did, and that's the same vibe, right? Like it's not the thread that unraveled the sweater necessarily, but it's definitely something that changed the course of the series. And you could look back at that game and say, like, one out of the 4 goals he gave up in, like, you know, 16 some odd minutes, whatever the fuck it was definitely his fault, and the rest of it was just Dallas playing horribly in front of him. But, you know, I mean, it's those moments that change a series. And yep. So,
and what similar we've come in a way to the Pedro thing, in that it was a case of a coach or manager trusting his guy, right? Like when your guy says, you know, I can go, put me in, leave me out here, I'm not giving you the ball. Like it's the boss's job to make the tough call. But at the same time, I mean, we got like whole sports movies based on this idea that when the star says I can do this, you back off and you let them do it. And when it works, they write screenplays about it. And when it doesn't work, you get this. And it's right. and let's be clear. Like if people haven't followed it, or if they're, you know, it's not that, you know, they didn't make a goaltending change. They didn't, you know, pull Hudobin out and say, like, it was a situation where they needed to use a different goaltender, apparently. Apparently, right. just going back to back was not an option. So, well,
and that's because, as Rick Bowness has said many times, Sean, they have the information that we do not have.
Sure,
and that is why they've made this decision.
Yeah. So, and that information just might be Anton Hudobin saying, "I'm not good back to back. Like, I really don't.
Right.
You know." And this is again, like, this has been kind of a running theme in the playoffs with goalies getting hurt or coming out and. Do you have a backup, and how good is your backup? And this is one of those areas where there is a difference between being a really good backup and being the guy, which is when you're a backup, you never have to play back-to-back games. Apparently Hudobin was not an option for that game. So now you're going, who am I starting? Do I start this kid with Jake Ottinger that has never played,
21-year-old.
Yeah, 21, yeah. Never played. You know, most fans have barely heard of. Or do I go back to Ben Bishop, who I'm told is ready to go? You know, yeah, he's going to be rusty. Yeah, there's risk with the guy. He's probably not anywhere near 100%. But he says he's ready to go. His coach says he's ready to go. Do I put him in there and have the big dramatic moment? And I don't think it was some sort of crazy indefensible decision to put him in there. I say that not knowing what it is that he's dealing with, and the fact that he was then immediately unavailable for the next game makes you wonder, like, if he is dealing with something that either got re-aggravated or that, you know, could there's certain injuries that you can just play through them, and there might be a pain or a discomfort factor, but it's not going to affect your performance. And there's other injuries that absolutely will. And goaltending, right. I mean, if you're a tenth of a second late pushing across, that can be the difference between a stop and a goal. So we need to know more, and it'll, I mean, this being the NHL, we won't know it until Dallas is out. But it's a fascinating story, and fair or not, it's the one that we're going to point to if Dallas loses. If they come back and win game 7, then, you know, we roll on, and it's one of those footnote things.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the injury part of this is the thing that's a tough one, right? Like, first of all, we don't know what it is because all these coaches are now playing grab ass with their goaltending situations and their injury status at this point in the playoffs. The last week has sort of been the thing that we all feared was going to happen with the unfit to play thing, which is, you know, obviously something they had to do because at the time we were thinking there was going to be like, you know, 10 COVID cases on every team. But now it's just become a situation where even guys that are getting injured in games are being called just unfit to play rather than there being any specificity about the injury.
Right.
So the real conundrum here isn't, hey, we started a guy that hadn't played since August 13th and he got bombed. I mean, that might happen. It's just hockey. The team in front of him played like shit. It's that now he's probably unavailable for the rest of the series. And that's the part that's just like, ooh, what happened here? Why did that occur? Because clearly, like, either he let on that he was healthier than he was, or he reaggravated or something. Who the fuck knows? But, like, the fact that he came in, got shellacked, and then doesn't have a like, the perfect time to start him would have been this game. That just was game six, right? To bring him back and redemption and your team played really shitty in front of you, and now they're going to play for the guy kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he couldn't go because he was hurt. And that's the part that's really tough to sort of swallow in this situation.
So that's what we need to know is what is the injury and what was it that went on around it? Because you're right. He probably, he's not 100%. Nobody's 100% a month into the playoffs, but he was clearly not even close to that. But did he tell the coaches that he could go? Yeah, he probably did. He's a hockey player. That's what they do. That you can't love Patrice Bergeron for going out there with a hole in his lung and then also sit there and be cranky when Ben Bishop or whoever says they're good to go when they're not. I mean, this is why it bugs me a little bit sometimes when you hear coaches say, like, well, you know, they're going to tell me. The player's going to tell me if he's good to go. It's like, yeah, well, the player's always going to tell you that he's good. And the few players that don't say that look after themselves and say, I'm not ready, we've seen coaches get up there and kind of roll their eyes and be like, well, I thought he was ready, but apparently he's not. And so it's a tough situation. But yeah, if it's a case where, you know, was he almost there and they just rushed it back a little bit and that caused a re-injury, okay, you know, that's maybe one thing. Or maybe he's just dealing with something where it's like, hey, I'm available when you need me, and I'm not going to be at 100%, but I can go. I can play, and, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, I always look at this stuff and go, like, okay, what if the opposite decision had been made, what would we be saying? And if Rick Bowness had put a 21-year-old in there, and the 21-year-old got shelled, we would all be sitting there going, what's wrong with Ben Bishop? You tell me you couldn't use him at all? Like, he can't, you know, we're knocking him, we're knocking Bonus. I don't know. It's just one of those things where if there's a goaltending decision to be made and the other team is really good, like the Avalanche are, and then you're going to be set up to be in a bad situation. And maybe that's what we should be talking about more, is the Colorado Avalanche do not look.
Man.
Yeah, this is, you know, you talk about letting someone off the ropes or off the mat. This is starting to feel that way. Obviously, they've got the injuries. We don't know, as we're recording this, exactly what the situation with Gabriel Landeskog is. But, you know, there was some talk earlier this week about some of the numbers as far as teams facing elimination having a very poor winning percentage in this tournament, and the suggestion that maybe knowing that you get out of the bubble and you get to go home might tip some teams just a little bit. Colorado does not look like they want to go home. Colorado looks like a team that knows they got a real clear shot at the Stanley Cup, and they kind of looked at each other and went, like, we're not blowing this. We're not doing it.
I'm sort of fascinated by that theory. So I don't necessarily think it applies when you're in the semifinals, right? Because, I mean, like, you're pretty damn close to potentially winning the Cup, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're down 3-1 in a series, you've come this far, you're going to keep on fighting. And we've only seen one team not force a game six, and it was Boston. And it was not for a lack of trying. I mean, the game went to overtime.
And there have been a few of those. Like, a few teams have been eliminated in overtime. It's not like...
Right.
The only team that I would point to and say, like, it looks like they really folded was the Coyotes against Colorado.
Well, I mean, in the playoff rounds? Because you, I mean, Jim Rutherford's on record saying, "Well, maybe they didn't want to be in the bubble," kind of thing. So, like, yeah. Pittsburgh's on that list. St. Louis, I mean, maybe they're on that list. I mean, it clearly didn't come together, and Binnington was shit. And I'm not saying that they didn't try. I mean, they fucking marauded back in that series for two games when O'Reilly went off. But the totality of that team was clearly maybe their heads weren't really into it. And you know, clearly as Doug Armstrong said, it was a fucking COVID riddled roster too. I think there's something to the theory that some of these teams, when they started staring into the abyss, just wanted to kind of go home. But I also think there's a flip side of that theory that really hasn't gotten much attention, which is the brevity of some of these series that some of these good teams have won could be one of these deals where, like, we just want to get the fuck out of here with the cup. Like, we just want to win every series in, like, five games. We'll go as quick as we can. If the other series is quick, that's awesome, too, that we can get going real early. We just want to get our shit done, get our spots in, go win the cup, get the fuck out of here. That's my competing theory to the we just want to go home and see our families and we'll lose theory.
Yeah, I don't know, because when it's the early rounds, it's, like, normally you're like, we want to finish it early, get some rest, and but right now it's like, oh, so we just get like 6 days off to play ping pong
in the squash courts.
Yeah. But, what's going to be interesting, and they're still working on this, is when or if they bring the families in for the conference final. And there's still talk around what that is actually going to look like. And because, yeah, I can imagine if you're in the conference final and you got a chance to finish a team and you know that, like, yeah, you might be looking at a week off hanging out with your kids, and like that could really be a reason to rally around and be like, all right, let's do this. But at the same time, maybe that lowers the temptation for the other team to pull the shoot. But I don't think teams have been like, the winning percentage was interesting to me, but I don't think anyone's suggesting that anyone was going out there like, guys, screw it, let's just go lose tonight and get out of here. But, you know, it's hockey. It's the parity world. Like, even that 2% drop in your will can potentially have an impact. So it's interesting to me.
Right.
But like, there was a piece on The Athletic where it was like the winning percentage was under 300, and I think teams are 3-0 since then. So it's
yeah, right. So you can't jump to too many conclusions on this shit. But it is pretty interesting.
Which is a good lesson. Always get that article out early if you have it. Like, don't save it for later in the week, because that's the hockey gods will always get you on it.
Not to pull the curtain too far back, but I wrote about officiating again today, specifically like the incredible numbers on home ice advantage or lack thereof for the officiating, as like the numbers for how many penalties a road team gets in a traditional playoff when fans are in the building versus what they're getting this season is fucking astonishing. But my point is that I went back and looked at the piece I wrote early August about playoff officiating, and it was like based on the first three games. Yeah. Which, I mean, there are definitely trends in the first three games, but I look back at it and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Using a three-game sample to jump to conclusions about officiating. But it was a good story. What are you going to do? You got people talking about it from the league. And if like people in the interviews are talking about it, all you can do is kind of follow their quotes occasionally and just like write the piece. But yeah, three games is what I was like freaking out about. It hasn't really gotten that much better, to be honest with you, but it's gotten a little bit better. Two players I want to talk about real quick on the series. McKinnon is just next level, like fucking just insane. Like, now he's just throwing alley-oop passes to Mikko Rantanen in front of the net, like setting records left and right. I think he's the best player in the world, and he's sort of just doing that thing where you will a team to victory. It's just fucking incredible hockey out of McKinnon in the series.
Yeah, he's been fantastic, and he's you know, it's interesting. We know now that, you know, when players peak, and especially forwards, and, you know, it's McKinnon is, he's younger than you think. He's only 25. And I think like just turned 25. So, you know, he's still a young guy, but he's already at that stage where, you know, we should have already seen his peak according to what the numbers tell us. And what he's doing now is a good case study in, you know what, maybe the speed peaks and the skill and the hands and all of that peaks early, but sometimes there's a few last little pieces that have to click in, and you just wonder if you're seeing that with him. And I'm not trying to, I don't want to invent a narrative here, because I mean the Avalanche were bad for years, so you know,
yeah.
was that Nathan MacKinnon not, you know, or was it just that he didn't have enough around him? But yeah, he is doing the get on my back sort of thing right now, and it's, I mean, that passing, the one-timer last night was insane. Like, I had to watch that 3 times, how perfect it was.
Incredible.
Like, there was, yeah, that was unbelievable. Yeah, he's the guy right now, and this is one of the fun things about the playoffs, is who's going to have the big coming out party. And it's not like Nathan MacKinnon was some undiscovered star. Like, we all knew this guy was really, really good. You know, nearly won a Hart Trophy a couple years ago, but this is next level. And man, the Avalanche looks so good right now. But again, I've watched enough playoff hockey to know that we're all shifting over to the Avalanche side of the bandwagon right now. It's like watching a big game of Fall Guys, and everyone's going over to one side, and there's like the one or two guys going the other way, and you're just like, hey, you don't know what you're doing. And boy, you could just see Game 7 going in a different way. But this is, well, this is great. I'm just glad we have a Game 7 finally in this playoffs. So thank you.
What makes it fun is it's two teams that don't know how to win a Game 7 that are now playing in a Game 7,
yeah,
which is like fascinating, you know. And so to me, the two real interesting things on the Dallas side are, like, one, the acquisition of Pavelski and Corey Perry was for a Game 7, so let's see what this looks like. And two, like, there's been a lot of top line players that have gotten criticism in these playoffs. The Flyers, we're going to talk about in a bit, are one of them. Fucking Tyler Seguin made $13.5 million in salary this season and doesn't have a point in his last 3 games of the series. I mean,
yep,
you can't put it all on one guy. There's other guys in that line. But it just seems like this is kind of the conversation about Seguin more often than not in these situations. And it's kind of becoming a thing.
And Rick Bowness has even sort of pointed this out. And it's, it's... I mean, Seguin was good last year.
Mm-hmm.
He
was.
And, you know, a lot, this is one of those things where it kind of...
You don't want to... It could be a bubble thing, like, for all we know. We can't judge it too harshly, because all these guys are going to act accordingly inside the bubble. But his absence is conspicuous in these last 3 games of the series.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, that's why you play Game 7. You know, there's always a chance for redemption. Yep. All right, let's touch on these other series. Vancouver and the Golden Knights. The Canucks continue their hockey bar mitzvah. They're pressing on. They're playing tonight as we do the podcast. I would be surprised if there was a Game 7 here. But the interesting thing from this series, obviously, is what Thatcher Demko did in Game 5. And, you know, you don't read too much into one start, obviously. But it's kind of amazing how quickly the conversation pivoted to, well, maybe we don't have to give Jacob Markstrom all that money.
Yep.
In like the span of one day.
it really was. Like, that is a... I know there was a clip of like Markstrom greeting him when he was coming off the ice and congratulating him. But yeah, you got to wonder if he's sitting there going like, oh, that cost me a lot of money. Thanks, kid.
Yeah, right? Or years. I mean, like, yep. One of the two. It's without question, like, a reframing of that situation. But the situation, I mean, if nothing else, it's probably just a reexamination, right? Like, if you look at it critically, you've been sort of bringing Demko along for a few years. Like, he's clearly sort of your goalie of the future. And you have to pay Hughes, and you have to pay Pettersson after next season. Like, it deserved probably more scrutiny than it was getting than sort of the default, well, obviously you pay Markstrom the money based on how he's played in the first couple rounds of these playoffs. So maybe it was just like a moment of reflection.
Yep.
More than anything else.
Or at the very least, it has to make you sit there and go, okay, if we give Markstrom 5 years at full-time starter money, what do we do with Demko? And you know, like, Thatcher Demko's been a prospect for years. I've written about this a little bit. Like, this is how it goes with goalies now, right? Like, they get drafted and you go, oh, we got a great goaltending prospect. And then it's like 7 years later, the guy right. is just slowly making his way through the system. And then finally, you know, he's 25 or whatever, he's here and he seems maybe ready to be the starter. And it's like, in the meantime, you've gone through three other guys and now you're like, okay, here's now we've got two guys. The goaltending situation is going to be fascinating in the offseason. Like, really, really interesting. There seem to be so many guys who are going to be either free agents in terms of like Robin Lehner, potentially available for trade, cheaper options. It's going to be fascinating to watch how that all shakes out. And, you know, I still think the Canucks will figure out a way to bring Markstrom back and just go with two guys. And if you've got too much goaltending, then you live with that problem. But yeah, he,
unless somebody pays him, like, unless somebody goes crazy. Cause I mean, he's an established starter in this league.
Mm-hmm.
I would be wary of the singing for his supperness of this season. His best season statistically happened in his walk year.
Yeah.
But to your point, like Markstrom, Corey Crawford, Robin Lehner, who might be top of the list. If you're Braden Holtby, you're doing the Markstrom Demko thing right now, watching all these guys in the playoffs. You're like, what the fuck am I going to do? Because like all these guys are playing really well. And then on top of that, you have the apparent availability of Freddie Anderson.
Yep.
You have the
Columbus
established
might
availability.
Move a guy. New York might want to move a guy. Like, and who
and
needs
Pittsburgh.
A guy? Is the
Pittsburgh's
question.
Yeah, the other one too with Matt Murray. Yeah. So like the goalie merry-go-round is really interesting. And who needs a guy? Well, Calgary probably could use a guy, right? That's
Calgary,
one team you look at and you're like,
Carolina,
there's an upgrade.
Edmonton.
Carolina.
And then the other thing here, though, is remember, you know, we're kind of – this sort of ebbs and flows, but it feels like the needle is starting to point to the side that says you need two goalies. You want two guys. You don't want the – well, we got expansion next year. You're only going to be able to protect one. So unless one of those guys is a younger guy who's not eligible, how many teams are looking right now going, I got two pretty good goalies that I like, but I'm going to lose one of them for nothing next year?
Yeah.
Or do I want to move them for something right now?
And that's why, you know, we ding Mark Bergevin a lot on the show because everybody he acquires, he tries to turn into a center. And also because he lied during the PK.
Oh, we're not allowed to make that joke anymore, Greg. Don't.
Oh, we're not?
You're going to hear... No, Montreal fans are now... Did you not hear Montreal has too many centers now? It's they're so deep at that position.
Well, it doesn't change the fact that he did that with like half the players he acquired.
Yes.
I mean, and honestly, Montreal fans need to check themselves because you have to realize that as you have two hockey humorists hosting this podcast right now, all they did was adopt the jokes that we used to make about the Sabres when they signed Ville Leino, and now we just used to make them about Montreal. It's the same joke. It's
recycling just, you know, is important. It's
right, exactly. So what they did with Jake Allen was fucking genius. To your point, like. 1 year left on his deal. They had the money to absorb the cap hit, even though it looks on its surface absurd that they have $14 million dedicated to their goaltending. You know, Carey Price plays 82% of their games last season. The backups have an .889 save percentage. And so bringing in Allen, who's a proven commodity and is a guy that you know can do this job of being in reserve and servicing a starter – it's fucking genius. Like, it was a really, really smart trade to make that trade if you're Montreal.
Yeah, I kind of have gone back and forth on it because I mean, first of all, Jake Allen is like the modern day Patrick Laline. He's a guy that
you
look at his numbers and they're really good, especially in the playoffs. But then you look at more the reputation is, I mean, like Jake Allen is a good goalie and he has good numbers. He also lost his job to a fourth string ECHL guy and then watched that guy lead a team to a Stanley Cup that Jake Allen had in last place. So, you know, I'm old enough to remember when fans in St. Louis were blaming Jake Allen for a lot of the problems that team had.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're legally not allowed to slander Jordan Binnington if Ryan's not here, by the way. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, exactly. We'll splice Ryan in later in post. I mean, Montreal, yes, you want to have a backup. But, man, $15 million on goaltending. And I know they've got cap space. And I know, you know, you look at the way that they're set up, they don't really... you know, all their guys that are key guys are already signed through next year. They've got a few RFAs, and then they've got Max Domi, and it certainly sounds like he's on his way out. He just hired Darren Ferris, and
yeah, you don't fire your GM's best friend as your agent. If
no,
you're gonna
and hire the Mitch Marner agent. Like, I mean, this guy is basically the John Wick of RFA negotiators that you've just brought in. So it's not hard to read the writing on the wall.
And Max Domi,
so they probably lose Domi, which is fine because they're so deep at center, you see. But yeah, you know that there's I'm of two minds on this, right? Like, on the one hand, you look at Carey Price and you go, if I'm paying $10.5 million to a goaltender, I'd like to think I don't have to spend nearly $5 million on a backup.
Right.
The flip side of it, and this is the kind of like Arpan Basu had like this metaphor that I really liked, which is it's what the Canadians have been doing for the last few years is like having like a luxury car that you spent a ton on, and then because you spent so much on the car, you go cheap on the maintenance. And the car starts to break down, and you need to, if you're going to spend that much on the car, you got to have something in the budget for the maintenance as well. And that's, you know, your backup goalie these days is basically your maintenance for your starter. I just don't, I mean, 4.5, man, $15 million on goaltending, giving up a decent pick for a guy that St. Louis was very motivated to move. Like, this is St. Louis trying to keep their captain, Alex Pietrangelo, where they needed the cap space for it. So, I mean, to give up, the fact that St. Louis in a salary dump basically got pretty good value is impressive to me. Doesn't mean it's a bad deal for Montreal. You can have win-wins. But I'm just, you know, I get that if I'm Mark Bergevin, I'm looking at all this cap space I have and I'm saying, what am I going to do with this? You know, I've got needs in certain spots. One of them is backup goalie. I'm going to spend some of my cap money on a backup goalie. And it's a one-year deal. They're not committed long-term or anything like that. It does make sense in that sense. But what else is going to shake? Like, we're heading into this offseason where everyone's capped out. Everybody's panicking. Cap space, to me, is such a valuable resource right now. And Montreal still has some. But they've got less than they did before. And I'm just wondering, like, what opportunities might disappear in the future because of a deal that they made the first week of September that I feel like they didn't really have to make right now when we just finished saying there's going to be so much goaltending available. Unless they really felt like Jake Allen was the guy and they had to have him, because obviously St. Louis is going to move him as soon as they possibly could. I don't know. It's just, the timing seems weird. This versus signing a guy for $2 million who can be a perfectly decent backup to Carey Price. Just,
but could you get a good backup for $2 million for 1 year? That's part of the equation too. Yeah. Is he's got an expiring contract.
I think you could, especially if you're willing to wait out the market a little bit. Like, there's going to be there's not as many chairs as there are goalies when the music stops. Right, there's going to be some guys that are going to get left out, and even if it's a veteran guy, then. Yeah, there's going to be options available. Again, there is something to be said for, yes, maybe we could do it cheaper later, but we can do it right now with a guy that we like and that we can afford. So just do it now, check something off your list, and you move forward. I get that. But I don't know. I think cap space is going to be so valuable that I think the few good teams that have it are in a position of a lot of power right now. And I just wonder if Montreal is going to feel like they got enough value out of that chunk of cap space they just gave up, even knowing that they've still got a decent amount left.
Makes sense. Islanders Flyers. You know, this has been an interesting series, and it's been a compelling series, but every time I see the Islanders and Flyers logos on the screen together, and then I see a game that doesn't look like an ECW hardcore match from the mid-90s, I get a little sad about what this series would have looked like, you know, 15 years ago. It is a well-played, chess matchy, ultimately bloodless series for me. And that's a little disappointing. I don't know where you are on it.
Yeah, it has felt that way. And I don't want to get into all this again, but this does feel like the series the Islanders wanted. You know, this is, and I won't say boring, but low event.
It's not boring.
I'll
walk back the Islanders boring thing. They can be a very exciting team. I mean, they definitely have exciting players. And, you know, when you are a counterpunch team and a lot of your goals are scored on the rush the other way, it's fun. But, like, it's just kind of there.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just because of, like, where we are as a league and, you know, our lizard brains are tricked into thinking about the Patrick Division when you see the Flyers and Islanders logos together in a playoff series. But it's just kind of, I don't know, like, vacuous and compelling. Sure, we might be going to seven. Who the hell knows? But, like, just not up to playoff standards. And maybe, again, maybe that's symptomatic of not playing these games in front of Philly fans and in Nassau Coliseum. I think it's probably a much different series if that's the case. But the way it is now, it's just there for a Flyers-Islanders series, and that's kind of a weird thing to consume.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And look, I mean, the Islanders are – they've got them on the ropes here. Like, this is – the Flyers are kind of dodging and weaving here. Three wins for the Islanders and then two overtime wins for the Flyers. So this series could very easily be over already. It's still compelling because it's we don't know at this point what some of the injury situations are heading into tonight, which could obviously influence one way or another. But
Alain Vigneault saw Matt Barzal in the elevator of their hotel and he had both eyes. So okay. He says he might be good to go. Yeah.
All right.
That's good to know. There Elaine's go. Got us.
Yep, he's having a strong playoffs. Okay, so yeah, it's been an interesting series, but yeah, it's not it doesn't offer up like the same hooks that some of the other series have. And I know if you're a Flyer fan or especially an Islander fan, you're going to go, "Well, it's because you're not looking in the right places." Maybe that's it. And you know, maybe we get get the other series over with, and it kind of clears the dance floor for these two teams to on a Saturday night game seven situation. But we got to get there first, and like I say, the Flyers are just barely hanging on at this point. So let's see what they've got tonight.
This series is prog rock. It's just like, I like it because it's rock, but I don't quite connect with it emotionally. Because it's just kind of going a little bit longer than I want it to go. And it doesn't really suit my needs as a rock consumer.
Oh, yeah. That works.
It's King Crimson. Tampa and Boston, they're done. Boston, obviously the only team in the semifinals to actually have gone home before we did this podcast. As we do the podcast, Zdeno Chara says he wants to come back, which is... I guess reassuring for those Boston players that looked like they were attending a fucking wake after losing game five. I mean, we have seen teams be sad and despondent after losing playoff series, sir. But like the Bruins looked like they were just like beside themselves after losing game five to the Lightning as far as like end of an era. David Krejci not even like looking up from the table to answer questions after that game, talking about like the window being closed and end of an era, that kind of shit. Where are you on Boston from an end of an era perspective? Do you think that they blew their last best chance at this? Or is there another kind of couple years of the Bruins before we can declare that?
Yeah, I'm not declaring them done by any stretch. And I think, you know, David Krejci was saying, like, you know, you look at this group and we may only have 2 or 3 years left, which is, you know, it is something you're not used to hearing a hockey player say, but at the same time, you're kind of like, yeah, dude, it's the NHL. Like every team, look at any team, they've got 2 or 3 years and then they're going to look very different from what they look now. That's just how it works at this point. But, you know, they've got, you've got two things working against them. There is the situation with the on the blue line with the contracts, and can you bring Torey Krug back, or do you lose him, and then what happens from there? And Chara, I assume if he wants to come back, will come back on a cheapish deal. They'll figure that out. But and then I guess you also have to figure out the goaltending. Just what is the deal with Tuukka Rask? Does he want to come back? And if so, what does that look like? But he's signed through next year. So, you know, from a cap situation, you're keeping the group together. It's the age factor. And you're just kind of sitting there going, like, a lot of these guys, so in their 30s, well into their 30s, Krejci, Bergeron, Marchand. I always hesitate, because anytime you ever say a team is an old team, you get their fans show up and they're like, well, what about this guy? What about this guy? Like,
right.
There's no 2002 Red Wings where everyone is 35 anymore. Like, obviously every team has, you know, their younger guys, and David Pastrnak, we may not even have seen his best yet. And some of the other guys, but the concern is the core, definitely without question, is older. There's no way around that, especially up front. And then this year they kind of made an effort to bring in some younger guys, and small sample size, but hasn't really clicked yet. Hasn't really worked. So long story short, I think Boston's still a contender next year. We kind of go 1 year at a time with these guys. 'Cause one thing we have learned is, when a player gets into their mid-30s, a lot of times it's a gradual decline, but a lot of times it's not. A lot of times it goes from, like, hey, that guy was really good, to, oh, that guy's 36, okay. Patrice Bergeron doesn't strike me as a guy who's going to have that sort of curve, but who knows?
Right.
What's interesting to me is, you know, what do you do as a GM when you've got a situation like this? Like, the window is not closed, I don't believe, but it is closing, and you can see that. So what do we do here? Do we say, okay, you know what? It's time to accept reality. We're not going to tear the team down by any stretch, but we got to start looking ahead to the future and what that next chapter looks like. And we got to start maybe even just behind the scenes with some smaller moves, looking ahead to long-term. Or do you say, you know what? I got to push whatever chips I have left into the middle of the table and try to win with this group. And then whatever happens after that happens. And it's tough. And we've seen teams, you know, the Bruins, and I hate this comparison, cause I don't think they're headed anywhere near this direction, but they kind of feel a little bit like the Sharks last year.
Oh, like,
people
yeah.
forget the San Jose Sharks were in the conference final last year. And everybody was like, well, you know, they're going to be good, but for how long? The window. And then it turned out the window just slammed shut on them. And I don't think the Bruins are set up for that, but there is that thing where a lot of people now look at Doug Wilson and they go, how come he didn't see this coming? How come he didn't make the moves that he needed to make to bring in some... Well, a lot of us didn't see it. You never see it until it's in the middle of happening and it's too late. So it's going to be really interesting to me. You know, I think Don Sweeney's a real good GM. He'll figure this out, but it's kind of the question of, what exactly do we do? They don't have their first round pick this year. So, you know, nobody's suggesting a rebuild. Nobody's suggesting you start moving veterans, but is there a point where you say, maybe, we don't rebuild, but maybe we move that one guy, or maybe we look in this direction and just try to get it. I know it was, I think there were a few teams. I think the Sharks were one of them. The Blues were another, where there was a time a few years ago where if you said a team's core was old, they would get mad at you and they'd say, we have two cores. We have our veteran core and then we have the younger core that's coming and already, uh-huh. you know, ready to replace
Which,
them. And
again, defies the definition of a core.
It
can't have two cores.
Exactly. But, you know, that's, you know, do you start looking at this and saying, okay, Patrice Bergeron won't be here forever. What does this team look like when it is very well and clearly David Pastrnak's team? And who does he have around him?
And it's
a tough question, because it's extremely hard to do both, you know, to get better right now and also build for the future. That's you kind of have to pick one or the other. And I think if I got a team that's this good, I'm looking for right now. But I say that understanding that 2 or 3 years from now, we might be looking at a mess and going, oh, they should have made the hard choices earlier.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to use the Sharks example, like they tried to turn their team over for mostly financial reasons to younger guys, and then realized the younger guys either weren't good enough or weren't ready. And so when you look at like Corey Pronman, our good friend the Prawn Dog, has the Bruins as the 23rd best organizational ranking in his NHL rankings, right? And the Sharks are a few ticks behind that.
In terms of it's not, guys 23 and under in the organization.
Right. Right. So it's not necessarily like the Bruins can do that, you know, get younger in spots and have these guys take over, because they might not just be deep enough to do it. And the Sharks were in the same boat. So that's a good comparison there. Briefly on the Lightning, I mean, great fucking win. You're in an interesting spot now with them where you have Braden Point, who is their leading scorer and doing the lion's share of the offensive work for that team, along with Kucherov. And then you've got Hedman, who scores the series-clinching goal, is doing Victor Hedman things. And I think I've long said that if they win the Cup, he wins the Con, just because of how much the writers love him. But it's those two guys kind of carrying the torch along with Vasilevskiy right now for a team that's kind of looking exactly what Julian Brisebois probably envisioned, which is your high-end guys are doing high-end guy things, and your grunts are doing everything you wanted them to do, including little plays like Pat Maroon screening the goalie for the big goal and shit like that.
Yep. And, you know, I was one of those people at the deadline was like, man, they're paying a lot to bring in third line depth, but that third line looks really good, and it's a big part. And we don't know Nikita Kucherov's status, but they look really good. And it's easy to forget. You watch them and you see them roll over a really good Boston team, and it's like, oh yeah, Steven Stamkos isn't playing yet. And we don't know if he's coming back. There's some question about that, but if he does, I mean, holy smokes, you're talking about adding like a top line scoring threat into a lineup that's already rolling. They look good, and it's the Lightning are so funny, because we spent the last year talking about the Lightning after what happened against Columbus and how they, you know, what's wrong with this team? They can't win in the playoffs. What is it? Is it about the way that they're built? Is it something mental? Is it coaching? Why can't they get over the hump? And then you kind of look back and you're like, oh wait, this, other than the Columbus year, this team goes to the conference final pretty much every single year. Like they have a lot of playoff success. They haven't won a cup with this group, but they've been to a final, a couple other conference finals. Like, this is a really good team, and they've been my cup pick all along. I'm going to stick with it. It's going to be interesting to see. This is sort of the first time that we're going to see the significant gap between one team having rest and one team not, especially if Philly and the Islanders go seven. So it'll be interesting to see. Normally that helps the rested team going forward, but maybe helps the other team in game one is the way you kind of conventional wisdom, but who knows, in a bubble, that could all be very different. But Tampa's in really good shape. They're a really good team.
They're great.
Yeah. And they're set up very well, and yeah, I made them my cup pick, and I haven't seen anything that's gonna make me change my mind.
Me too, and again, like, really smart moves in the off season last year and during the season this year to just make sure they had the depth. You know, get to the playoffs.
I really wonder if that, especially if they win, if that causes like a change in thinking at the deadline, away from I'll trade my first round pick for a big name for 1 year to rent a guy versus I'll trade my first round pick for an okay guy that's on a cheap deal for a couple of years and bring him in to fit in. And it was a different way of thinking, and it's so far, you know, we're basing this on a month, but it's working, and it made a lot of sense.
That's a smart. That's a smart call. LeBron wrote the other day about how, like, you know, the trade deadline isn't a place that teams usually do business, and could Tampa change that? And like, we're only a couple of years removed from the Penguins adding Carl Hagelin and Justin Schultz at the deadline. So it's like, it's not as if the trade deadline hasn't benefited cup-winning teams in recent memory. But I think your take's a good one, which is that maybe they just go about their business a little bit differently and target different players. But also, like, you know, clearly addressing the need for, you know, a certain type of player that I think was a response to how they lost last year. I mean, like, you get Blake Coleman or Barclay Goodrow or Pat Maroon on your team, you're doing that knowing that those are the types of goals that you need in a series against Columbus you didn't get from your tippy-top guys. So it was smart. And again, like, the more depth you have and then you face injuries, the more you cover your own ass. Speaking of covering your ass, today's episode of Puck Suit was sponsored by Mack Weldon.
Pretty good.
I am right now covering my ass with a nice pair of Mack Weldon shorts. Breezy, comfortable. Got a bunch of their underwear as well. Got a polo from them too. All of it is just super comfy. And whether you're lounging around the house, still working at home or what have you, or you're out and about during the summertime, it's great clothes to have indeed. Premium fabrics, smart designs, simple shopping. It's the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants you're going to ever wear. They have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. It's important. The folks at Mack Weldon have even created their own totally free loyalty program called Weldon Blue. Level 1 gets you free shipping for life. And once you reach level 2, by spending $200, Mack Weldon will start giving you 20% off every order for the next year. That is an amazing deal. I love all the Mack Weldon stuff I've gotten. I'm definitely going to pick up more of the underwear. That's for sure. Very, very comfy. The shorts, like I said, they not only are they comfortable, they look good too. They're kind of slimming on your boy, if we're being honest. For 20% off your first order, visit Mack Weldon, MackWeldon.com/puck. That's MackWeldon/puck. Enter the promo code PUCK, P-U-C-K, and check it out, man. Again, we don't like to promote stuff on this show that we don't use or that we don't like. This is something we like. It's quality stuff, and I think you're going to really dig it.
I had another shipment arrive a couple of weeks ago, and yeah, it's good stuff. The underwear is great, and got a couple of sweaters too, and yeah. It's good stuff.
It's good. It's good. Yeah, and they've got like the cool, like really nice, like sweatpants where you can diddle around your house in them and stuff. It's good stuff, man. You check out Mack Weldon's website, MackWeldon.com/puck. Enter the promo code PUCK for 20% off your first order. That's going to come in handy. Thanks to Mack Weldon for sponsoring the show. All right. Well, we got ourselves a GM hiring this week. That's always exciting. As Bill Zito, a guy that I have lobbied for several years to get a gig as the GM in this league, gets his job with the Florida Panthers. That, I believe, Sean, leaves Mike Fiuta as the only guy who is an assistant GM who gets to interview with every job for every job but never gets it as the last man standing. Paul Fenton got hired briefly.
Uh-huh.
Bill Zito gets the 5-year deal in Florida. So Fiuta's the only guy left from that list, right?
Yeah, he's the only guy left of the fictional made-up names that are just like computer-generated to fill out the... Yeah, it's I am fascinated by not the hiring process that goes on with these jobs, but the behind the scenes getting your name out there as having been considered.
Done it. Right.
It's fascinating to me because it's interesting. Like if you read closely, there are guys that are reported as interviewing for a job. And if you see the word interview, you can assume that it happened. But then there's other guys that are reported as like in the running or being considered. Yeah. And I just wonder how much of that is guys who are good sources to certain insiders and then turn around and be like, hey, can you put my name out for this so that, you know, so that we keep it up? Because there's certain guys that are just like every year when there's an opening, you're just like, really, John Ferguson Jr. again is getting mentioned on this? Is somebody lining up 15 years later for that opportunity? I would love to know how that all goes down. But yeah, congratulations, Bill Zito. Eight teams, I think, was the number that he had been considered for, and he finally gets it. So you know, you stick with it, and now he's got his opportunity, and it's an interesting one. I'll say that.
Zito, I think, was like a very, very late stage finalist for the Devil's job that Fitzgerald ended up keeping. But he's been a bridesmaid so many times for this stuff, so it was good to see them finally get the job. To your point about like who's putting that info into the world, so who is putting the NHL wants to get Peter Chiarelli a job info into the world? Because that's been a thing in the last couple of months. Where is that even?
And I don't know where that's coming from, because that doesn't... I'm not sure who that benefits, right? Like, if you're Peter Chiarelli, you don't want everyone to know that you're being interviewed because Gary Bettman says so. Like, that's like being the kid.
Yeah.
Like, you only got invited to the birthday party because your mom, you know, made the other...
Right.
Like, or made a phone call.
You're the pitcher on the Little League team because your dad's the coach or some shit. Like, exactly. It's just not cool.
So I don't know where that's coming from. That is interesting to me, but the other thing that's interesting about the Panthers is this report that Chris Drury that he removed himself from the running and either was deep into the process or potentially even the favorite, and then said, no thanks, I'll go back to the Rangers, which is always makes you wonder, A, is that what happened? And if so, what did Chris Drury see in that process that made him not want to take the job? Or is it maybe more of a case of somebody realizing that, you know, they weren't going to get a job and putting it out there that they walked away from it? I don't know. But that's...
I still don't know why he didn't... I mean, like, if he wanted a gig, just have the Pegulas pay you $10 million a year and come save the Sabres. Like, that's the gig you should have taken.
That's the one I was surprised he didn't get.
Yeah.
But I guess...
If I'm Chris Drury, just fucking hang out for a few years and see if you win a cup with the Rangers. You know, like, you're just going to add zeros to the end of your asking price if that happens.
Well, you're going to add, except, you know, then at what point do you become the new Mike Fuda, where you're just, you know, how many years have we been saying that this guy's going to get a job somewhere, sometime, and there's not a lot of these jobs. There's only so many.
Yeah.
They only open up so often, and I'm not saying you take anything, because obviously there's got to be some level of fit, but... to be turning down potential offers is interesting to me, if that's actually how it played out.
Another opening that's still sort of open, Steve Sullivan is the interim guy, is Arizona, which, I mean, what's even your read on that? Like, there's probably a certain amount of, like, support to just keep him around for consistency's sake.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a lot of also support of bringing somebody in to shift the paradigm on a roster that probably isn't all that good that John Jacob put together there. You know, this guy's name's come up before for gigs. And I've always said that the right spot for this guy is a place where you need a little bit of a carnival barker, where you need somebody to run the organization and also sort of be the face of the franchise a little bit and get people hyped up. When Ottawa had an opening, I thought that this guy would have been perfect there as sort of the antithesis or antagonist of Brian Burke when he was in Toronto. Pierre Maguire, Arizona Coyotes GM. What do you think?
You're just trying to get him off TV, and we all know
doing. Yes, and but still... I mean, if you're looking for a sort of like malleable personality less franchise that, you know, could use. I mean, listen, I mean, he's got Pittsburgh ties, I believe, right? Sort of Tockett's there, you know. I don't know. I feel like a big personality is needed for that job to sort of give that franchise a little bit of personality now that they're not going to be the analytics franchise anymore. And like, why not? If ever there was a place for him to go, and listen, this is not like speaking out of our asses here. This man is interviewed for big jobs. He interviewed for the Penguins job.
This guy has certainly had his name out there for all the big jobs.
To go back to your previous point, correct.
I wonder if you go back and reread how many of them actually say that he interviewed versus was just in the running. Here's the thing. We've heard, as far as guys who aren't currently in front offices and are in the media instead, we've heard him, we've heard Ed Olchuk, we've heard Kevin Weeks.
Kevin Weeks, yep.
I guess there's, and that, all three of those make me nervous, just because being a GM of an NHL team is such a hard job and such a complicated, multifaceted job that somebody coming in fresh who hasn't been in a front office at all would really make me wonder. Now, these guys are super well connected and maybe they surround themselves with the best of the best and you're fine, but that would really make me wonder. But that becomes a question then. What do you do if you're going to bring in someone who doesn't have that firsthand experience? Do you bring in a guy like Kevin Weeks, who's at least, you know, younger, some fresh ideas, modern guy, or do you bring in a guy like Pierre McGuire, who did the job 20 years ago and didn't do it particularly well? I mean, he was awful as a coach, not great in the front office. It's one thing to, you know, bring in a guy like a Brian Burke who had success 20 years ago and think that he can pull it off again in what would be a very different league. Why are you bringing back guys who didn't have success 20 years ago?
This spot seems to me like it's going to be a name. It doesn't seem like it's going to be a Fuda or someone like that. It feels like it's going to be one of those Shirelli, Ray Shiro, guy on TV type jobs. And maybe it's like the fact that you have a guy who's a Vegas landowner as your boss, as the owner of the team now, and you know that he's going to want a little bit of flash to it. I just get the feeling that this is going to be one of those hires where we will not have to run to Wikipedia to figure out who this fucking guy is when they hire him. Like, we're going to know who it is when they hire him, yeah, for sure.
Here's the flip side of that is that, like, this is a team where, like, GMs don't sell tickets. Do they get people talking? Maybe. This is a team that had Wayne Gretzky as their coach for a few years. The greatest, most famous hockey name ever was not just in the organization, but was the coach. You could buy a ticket. You could go and look at Wayne Gretzky. Like, he was right there.
You could touch him.
And it didn't, you know, that didn't turn anything around. They didn't sell any more tickets. And the reason they didn't is because he wasn't very good as a coach. So the team wasn't very good. And that's ultimately what determines how successful you are. So, yeah, I mean, you could bring in a personality, but if that personality is not qualified to be an NHL GM, it's just going to get worse. And, there is that. The flip side of what you just said is there are some markets, bigger markets, where you say, you know, we need someone who can handle the media. We need someone who's, you know, got the strong voice that they can deal with all this stuff. Arizona might be a market where you go, you know what, we don't get a lot of attention anyways. Let's just bring in the smartest, best person we can find. And even if it doesn't, you know, even if they can't do the rest of the stuff and be the carnival barker, that's okay because nobody's listening to the carnival barker anyways. So let them just do the job. Granted, that kind of is what they thought they were doing with John Chayka, and here we are a few years later. So
go get the good version of John Chayka. Go hire Eric Tulsky from Carolina, our good friend.
Yeah.
It's the way to go.
You could do that.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Todd Reirden gets fired by the Capitals, goes back to the Penguins. Penguins fans celebrate. He, of course, was the architect of a very good blue line for many years in Pittsburgh. He immediately praises Jack Johnson. Penguins fans say, get the fuck out of here. Go back to Washington. Pretty much.
Yep.
What's the news cycle this week? But again, what do you expect him to say? Like, if he says anything critical of Jack Johnson, he is basically just like pissing in the Cheerios of the guy who just signed his check. Right. I mean, it's clear that Jim Rutherford, for whatever reason, has affinity for Jack Johnson, and Todd Reirden is there to make the most of that situation because he's not going anywhere, apparently.
That's it. So. And it's, I can't remember. I'm sure it's happened, but for a guy to be fired as a head coach and to find a new job that quickly as an assistant is unusual. Like, we've seen guys get fired as head coaches and take other head coaching jobs quickly because, like we just said with GM, there's only so many of these jobs out there. It's probably smart. I mean, this is Todd Reirden being self-aware enough to go, you know what, the way things went down in Washington, for whatever reason, I'm not getting offered a head coaching job next. Right. My next stop is going to be either head coach in the minors or assistant, like one of those two stepping stone jobs.
You got to do your hockey penance, you know.
So go take a spot somewhere. I mean, Pittsburgh would obviously is a good landing spot. Not even in the sense of a potential opening as at head coach, although with the way Rutherford's talking, you never really know. But you know, you've got a chance to work with the best player in the world. You got a chance to win. You got a chance to be part of what would be perceived as a turnaround story. It's a smart landing spot. It's just interesting to me to see a guy be self-aware enough and not sit there and go, no, I'm going to hold out for a head coaching job. And next thing you know, it's a year or two later and you're sitting there going, yeah, probably should have just gone to Pittsburgh.
Yeah. To answer your question, it feels very Belichickian. Like when those like Patriots guys would leave and go get other jobs in the NFL, and then like they flop and then they immediately come back and rejoin his staff. It's kind of how it feels. Our friend Frank Saravelli, once in future Puck Soup guest, assuming we ever have guests again, released his trade board. This is what Frank does at TSN. He has the trade board, and it's all the players that could be traded. And on the list, number five on the list, to the surprise of many this week, Sean, Patrick Laine.
Yeah.
With the 1 year left on his contract, with the you know, the down year by his goal scoring standards, only 28 in 68 games. Almost immediately, every pundit in the world started playing matchmaker with the Carolina Hurricanes, trying to find a way to get Patrick Laine to play with Sebastian Aho. Noting that, you know, the Hurricanes have much of what the Jets need, which are defensemen. Would you get out of the Patrick Laine business if you were the Winnipeg Jets, though?
I mean, my short answer will be the same answer I almost always give with this sort of question, which is I'd certainly be open to it. I'm a GM. It's my job to try to make my team better. I'm not writing any options off. Patrick Laine's obviously a good player and has the potential to be a very good player. He's not untouchable. Mm-hmm. He hasn't done anything in this league to make him somebody that you just can't, you got to hang up the phone if somebody calls. I mean, the Jets need serious help in the blue line. They could use some help down the middle in that middle six. Guys like that cost you something. So, you know, they're then going to look and say, okay, what do we have? Maybe an area of strength, and the forwards, especially on the wing, is that area of strength. So, yeah, you absolutely are going to look at, is there a situation out there where we can get better making this trade? Now, a lot of times the answer to that ends up being no. There just isn't. You shop a guy around or you listen to offers, however you want to phrase it, and then there isn't something there that makes sense. But I would absolutely be willing to consider that sort of move. And that's what if I'm a fan, that's what I want my GM doing. I don't want him sitting there, you know, deciding that half the team is untouchable and, you know, we're not even going to talk about him. This would make sense for the Jets under the right circumstances to at least explore it, which is not the same as saying you got to move the guy because you clearly don't. And chances are he's in the lineup opening night next year, and we all move on. But yeah, I mean, you've had a disappointing season. You've got clear needs. Go out and see what potential solutions there could be. That's your job.
You've kind of encapsulated the reaction to this from everywhere, which is he's obviously not available. They're obviously not shopping him. But it wouldn't shock you if it happened. And I would be shocked if it happened. I think it'd be fucking bonkers to trade Patrick Laine right now, to be honest with you. 138 goals in his first 305 games. You know, a down year this year, still had 63 points in 68 games. Like, this is a fucking elite talent. And the idea that you would dangle this guy out there instead of doing the thing you should fucking do, which is to get him a center, is just insane to me. And I'm sure there's some logic behind it. I'm sure Frank heard something from somebody about him being available or what have you. I
mean, oh, like, well,
they
do have clearly, to give him a new... Clearly,
We're
not shopping
a new contract,
guy.
Too.
Yeah. That's it. Like, you know, you're looking at Patrick Laine and you're going, like, it always feels like... This guy, he'll have a few weeks where he looks like he's the next Ovechkin, and then it kind of falls off, and the numbers are never quite what you think, and you always feel like there's more there, which makes him harder to trade, because, you know, well, what if we trade him, and then he blows up and has the 50-goal or 60-goal year somewhere else?
You know what it sounds like? It sounds like early Tarasenko is what it sounds like.
Could be.
Like, you know, what's this guy going to be? Oh, my God. What do we do? And then, like, you know, they stuck with him. And then they, you know, won a cup with him. And he was very productive during that run. I know why this is happening. Like, he had not the best goal-scoring season. His numbers have trended down the last two seasons. He's due a new contract.
That's key. We just went through 1 year ago, like, a pretty tough negotiation with Patrick Laine on what turned out to be a bridge deal.
Yep.
The bridge is up after next year. So this is when you say, like, you know, there's more in the tank. What if he goes up? Well, yeah, well, what if he does have the big blow up year this year? Then what? You know, how are you? You're already paying him almost $7 million against the cap. What if he finally has that 1 year and then he says, okay, now I'm a $10 million winger. I want Mitch Marner money. I want, you know, it's. Can you do that? And the other thing you have to keep in mind when it comes to the Jets, and they don't, Kevin Cheveldayoff is a guy who hasn't done a lot of trading, but it's, and you kind of hate to say it, and it can be overemphasized as a factor, but if you're the Winnipeg Jets and you're sitting there going, we need help on the blue line, we need a second line center, your options in free agency are not the same as they would be for other teams. You're not a destination.
You're not going to get them.
You're never going to sign anyone. But A, some people just don't want to play in Winnipeg, and B, some people who do want to play in Winnipeg, you're going to have to pay a premium to get them versus what some other team might offer, and that's just the reality. So if you've got a chance to trade for somebody who's got years left of team control on their contract, I think you have to consider doing it, because your odds of doing it through free agency or doing it even for veteran guys that you can, you know, you say, well, what about a rental? What about a 1 year deal? And a veteran guy, well, if he's got a no trade, you are probably on it. So it does make it a little tougher. So that means you got to trade for younger guys, which means you're going to have to give up younger guys. That's just how it's going to work.
Mm-hmm. You said that a lot of people don't want to play in Winnipeg.
Is it because they have no parks there and they all live on the ground and they don't have any parks?
That is exactly the reason, yes.
If the Jets trade Patrick Laine for Brett Pesce, just fucking fold the franchise. That's kind of how I feel about it. Before we get to some other stuff, real quick. So we should mention and follow up on the fact that we were very critical of the players for not postponing their games at the same time that the other sports did. I still think they did the wrong thing. I also think that it's pretty hilarious. I watched the first episode of Quest for the Cup last night on ESPN Plus, and I have a sort of a recap of the show on ESPN this morning if you want to check it out. It's a good episode. They definitely need to do more on-ice chirping, which is one of my favorite things from 24/7. There wasn't, like, any of it last night. It was kind of weird. But they also sort of did a NHL edit on the timeline of what happened with the protests. Like, they kind of indicated, oh yeah, the teams talked about it and they decided that they were going to play. No, that's not how it worked. Like, they didn't talk about it. like you literally had coaches after the game being like, well, if anybody had brought it up, we probably would have talked about it. So that was kind of a weird flex to see the NHL rewrite history a little bit on that. It was not a situation where the teams mulled over whether they shouldn't play that night and then decided to play. They just didn't even talk about it. Half the guys were napping during the NBA stuff and were forthright in saying that. It was only the next day that shit happened. And so the next day shit did happen. And so, you know, looking back on it and that decision to not play for a couple days was a really powerful moment. I mean, I don't think any of us are going to soon forget the image of, you know, Edward Bellmare and Nazem Kadri and Ryan Reeves standing front and center in front of, you know, a few dozen Western Conference players delivering that press conference. I mean, that's a really, really striking visual and some shit that we had never seen before. And it was powerful at the end of the day. Would it have been more powerful to join the other sports? So when every news organization in the world wrote about the protests, the NHL wasn't conspicuous by its absence? Probably yes. But at the end of the day, they did something and it was admirable.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it was like we said, it was a day late. And when we talked about this a week ago, we addressed that. We said if they do something different today or tomorrow, then that will be one thing. But the time to have done it was the same day that the NBA did it. And I stand by that. I've had people on Twitter come up to me like, are you going to revise now that the... No, I'm not revising what I said last week, because last week I was addressing and we were addressing what the NHL had failed to do in support of the NBA at the time that the NBA was doing it. And that said, as far as, okay, the next day is a new day, you missed your opportunity. I think they've acknowledged that, the players largely have. What do we do from here? And I think what they did from there was the right thing, and I'll give them credit for that, even as I still wish that they had done it a day earlier.
Yeah. The other thing to say about this was, again, you can't underscore enough how important the role the Hockey Diversity Alliance has played in a lot of this stuff, acting as exactly as you'd hope they would, which is as sort of a ombudsman for the NHL's lack of effort on some of these things and some of these issues, and also as a sounding board for players looking for more information. And so, you know, the HDA has these Zoom conversations with players over the 2 days in which they weren't playing to kind of talk about these things and educate them and talk about next steps. That's really impressive. The HDA served its best purpose, I think, during this. And then they went out and released the pledge that they wanted the NHL to sign off on. They gave it to the NHL on July 14th. They're still waiting for the NHL to sign off on it. And it is a 8-step pledge. Here we go. Ready? Increase the number of black employees at all levels in the NHL. Well, that's something that you could probably get behind. Makes a lot of sense. Ensure procurement of an inclusive and diverse supplier base. This was an interesting one because basically they want 10% of the league's procurement expenditure for, like, hockey supplies, office supplies, whatever, to come from predominantly black-owned businesses. I think that's a reasonable ask. That's the smart move. Ensure that the voices of black players are heard. Sure, obviously. They want to impose a requirement that at least 50% of the executive inclusion committee shall be comprised by members selected by the HDA. Well, that's an interesting one. I don't know if Gary Bettman is really into the outside organization tries to select members of NHL committees thing. That might be a tough one to get to. Number 4, implement anti-racism education for all league employees. Why aren't we doing that already? Fuck. Mm-hmm. Do we not have that? Is that possibly true? Is it possibly true in a post-Bill Peters world we don't already have this? Oh, by the way, Bill Peters still not suspended. Just want to point that out. Number 5, create a zero tolerance policy to abolish racial discrimination and abuse. HDA approved policies and sanctions that reflect a commitment to zero tolerance respect to racial discrimination and abuse before the start of next season. That sounds reasonable. They should be a policy in place anyway. That way Bill Peters, you know, would be suspended. Number 6. Here's a fun one. Ready, Sean?
I'm ready.
They want the NHL to sign off on a pledge that says we will not support, partner with, or accept support from any organization that is engaged in, promoted, or failed to appropriately respond to racist conduct in their organization of any kind. Now, that is a wide-ass net they're casting. I mean, you are talking about media companies that the NHL has partnered with. You are talking about Hockey USA. I mean, if you're talking about the Van Beesbrook thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a lot of organizations, and I would be fascinated to see if the NHL ever did sign off on that, who the HDA is thinking about there.
Right, because that puts a tremendous amount of power in the HDA's hands in that, you know, as awful as it is to say, these days, you know, how many organizations actually are handling this stuff the right way? Or in a way that's unimpeachable, right? That nobody can point to and say you're not doing enough. So it really does give the HDA almost not veto power in the actual sense. You know, the NHL could ignore them and say we're going to continue. We think whichever organization it is has done enough, and that's it. But from a public perception point of view, it gives the HDA tremendous power over a lot of this stuff. And you know what? Is it too big of an ask or too broad of an ask? Yeah, probably. That's where they should start on this stuff. You know, the NHL hasn't earned the benefit of the doubt. Ask big. If the eventual pledge that gets signed, assuming there is one, looks different, you know, let's not pick it apart. Let's not say, you know, if this word got changed or this got this ask isn't as broad anymore. That doesn't mean it's a failure. It doesn't mean that anybody did anything wrong. It's ask big. You know, the HDA is doing important work, and they have a moment here where they've got some power, and they're using it, and that's what they should be doing. And if the final result ends up looking not quite like this, then that's okay too.
Number seven, transparent communication to the HDA of all actions related to this ask. Because if you know anything about Gary Bettman's NHL, they're all about transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And number eight, commit to funding HDA programs, initiatives, social justice initiatives, grassroots hockey initiatives, creating anti-racism and unconscious bias training programs for use of minor leagues across North America. We've talked about this before. Their ask is $100 million over a 10-year period. Which is a lot for a new organization. But like you said, they've got a lot of leverage now, and they've got a lot of support, and they've got some smart backing behind them. So we'll see what happens with these things. I do find it, again, fascinating that the NHL is trying to run parallel to this organization, their own diversity initiatives internally, like committees that have Gary Bettman and Kim Pegula on them and others. So you wonder if we're headed towards an eventual collaboration, or at least the NHL's desire to collaborate, or maybe not. And I frankly think that the HDA working independently of the NHL is the best place for them to be. But that's just me. So it was interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right, a couple things before we say goodbye. We are going to do a segment called Mailbag Lost Letters. These are entries in the Puck Soup Mailbag from the Patreon from older mailbags that we never got to, but they were interesting. And I figured that Sean and I would answer a couple of them on the podcast this week. Ariel Rojo wants to know, if no number were off limits and you played in the NHL, what number would you choose? It's a very good question.
My number, when I was a kid and I pictured myself in the NHL, my number was always 71. I grew up, I was a Wendell Clark fan, but obviously I couldn't take Wendell Clark's number because he was going to be playing on my line when I eventually made the Leafs. So I was going to flip it around. And when I was a kid, there weren't a lot of 71s. It was kind of a cool number. And then like Mike Foligno wore that with the Leafs, which is fine. And then David Clarkson came along and ruined it forever. But I still feel like that's, you know, when I'll acknowledge my odds of making the NHL are not looking great right now. I feel no. like I've, my yeah. window is
ever
increasing,
ever decreasing. I'd say, yeah.
But it could still happen, and if it does, yeah, 71 is the one I'm going to be breaking out, and it's not a Evgeny Malkin tribute. It's a that was just as a kid flip Wendell's number, and I thought it would look cool. So when I was like typing myself into video games, that was me with 71 number, 99 speed, 99 shot. It was good.
40 aggression.
No, it maxed that out, and then I put like 90 for passing because it felt weird if you just went maximum across the board. Like, you had to be realistic. So,
my number as a little leaguer was 47. I always liked that number a lot. Okay. Doesn't really translate to being a good hockey number unless you're like a 5'8" defenseman, or maybe 5'6". I would probably go, honestly, that I think the coolest looking number in hockey is 88. I've been a fan of that since Lindros. I think Nate Schmidt in 88? Am I imagining
yep.
that?
Yep. Burns, Vasilevsky, Kane. There's quite a few.
I do love an 88. So I'd probably take that as my number. But the real answer is kind of what Sean was getting at, which is you take whatever number is the easiest to become the best at that number on a given team. Like, if you get traded to the Devils and there's never been a 71 in Devils history, you fucking become 71. Become the best 71 in Devils history.
That's right.
It's like, you don't go there and take, like, 15 or some shit, or, like Langenbrunner did. You're trying to, surpass the legacy of John McClain. Come on, what are you doing?
Absolutely.
Ryan Caldwell wants to know, what random quotes from random movies do you find yourself quoting in front of people who have likely never have seen the movie? For me, it's Rose goes in the front, big guy from Bull Durham, and yeah, hence from The House Bunny. Wow, quoting The House Bunny around.
Yikes.
I'll give you a movie that I quote a lot that I don't think everyone has seen, which is the Ryan Reynolds, Anna Faris classic, Just Friends.
You're probably correct.
There's a line in that movie. Yeah, there's a line in that movie I use with frequency. Whenever somebody is identified from being from New Jersey, I use the line, come on, he's Jersey. He skis in his jeans, which I think is just like the greatest indictment of the New Jersey winter sports guy. But Just Friends is a plethora of quotes that I use a lot in life, but I don't think a lot of people have seen them. And then I would probably also say that, like, there's a healthy amount of Mystery Science Theater 3000 quotes that I probably incorporated into my own lexicon that people don't know. And I'll tell you this too. I was reminded of this, like, we're in sort of the Bill and Ted zeitgeist again because the new movie came out, which I am on the fence about seeing. I don't really know if I want to see a couple of like 50-year-olds trying to do Bill and Ted. I'm sure it's fine.
You're gonna see it.
Let me rephrase that. I don't want to pay to see it. Okay. If it's around in front of me, I'll probably watch it. But like, I've been using "Strange Things Are Afoot at the Circle K" throughout the entirety of my life, and I often wonder how well known that line is for anybody who isn't my age and kind of grew up with Bill and Ted. Cause that is maybe a weekly line that I've used in life.
Yeah. That one's a common one. I struggle with this question because I have like a whole segment of my brain that is apparently completely devoted to, and for me, it's usually when I read something, just instantly spitting out some pop culture reference, whether it's a song lyric or a line from a show or a movie, but I don't say it out loud. And the question was like something you say in front of people, which, first of all, I haven't had a conversation with an actual person in
like months.
6 months in person. So I don't remember what that's like, but no, I'm not like, I don't like throw out lines in front of other people, but they just happen in my head. But I will say, and I've mentioned this before, but I say it again because I'm proud of it. Having watched a good chunk of I Think You Should Leave With My Kids and seeing them incorporate that, against each other or against their mother who hasn't watched the show, like is it, like anytime I've noticed that anyone in the house says that something is a good idea, a kid will immediately jump in with and saying that they stand by it in the focus, like the car focus group guy accent. Or if we're watching something and somebody drops a random F-bomb into it, the one of the mm-hmm. kids will be like, "Don't swear. What game show do you know that has swearing? Jeez." You know, it's just... So my answer is I don't really do it, but I feel like maybe it skips a generation because the kids are already on this stuff. And God help you if you go to a restaurant with my kids and order nachos. You're done for at that point.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you should leave. It's definitely now become the purveyor of many catchphrases and communications in my life. A couple more. East Bay Rye. What does your ideal burger look like if you're grilling at home for yourself or your family? What kind of bun, cheese, toppings, and condiments are you using? So this is an interesting question because we've been eating a lot of veggie burgers, Ruby and I, for the last year because she's not a big – she will eat a steak, but she's not a big like beef burger fan. So we would have a turkey burger. We'd have a veggie burger. The burger itself doesn't matter to me. It's how you dress it up, and here's how I dress it up. Brioche bun. You need to have some kind of green. I mean, I would prefer spinach over anything. I think that works well. Cheese, that sort of depends on the burger. I am a New Jersey suburbs boy, so just a slice of American is fine by me. But if you're having a turkey burger... I like a good slice of Havarti cheese on the burger. As far as condiments go, well, please keep in mind that I used to work at Burger King. So the ketchup-mayo-whopper combination is unimpeachable, in my opinion, as far as condiments go. So that would be it. Oh, and also a slice of raw onion. I love the crunch and the pungent taste of a raw onion on a burger as well. So raw onion, spinach, ketchup mayo, brioche bun, and then whatever the fuck you want the burger to be is fine by me. What about you?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because literally every year, every grilling season, I say that this is the year I'm going to learn how to actually make a good burger and not just buy frozen stuff and to keep in my freezer and throw on the grill. I'm actually going to make, I'm going to mix the ground beef and, I'm going to form the patty and really make a good burger, and I never do it. And if I didn't do it this year, I mean, when's it actually good? I gotta just accept that I'm frozen burger guy, I'm not super picky on that. I'm not even, and I'm not a cheeseburger guy. Bun, I mean, I've got two kids, so it's kind of whatever. I do like to toast the bun. I think that does make a difference. But it's a good enough burger, toasted bun, and then it's all in the condiments, and I'm a good mix guy. I'll throw in a little Thousand Island dressing. That's kind of your simulated Big Mac sauce, which I think is pretty similar to what you're getting at with the ketchup mayo, and then a couple of pickles. My son is carrying on this tradition. He's becoming like, how many pickles can I get on this burger guy? Like when we go to a, we go to a Hardee's where you can actually pick
bar.
Out.
Yeah.
Like he'll actually sit there and like, no, keep it going. And I think his record is 9 slices of dill pickle, which is pretty good, until the excruciating stomach pain starts half an hour later, but it's worth it. So yeah, I in my head, I'm more of like I aspire to like a level of burger artistry that I'm realistically have just never attained.
I don't know where we are as a society when it comes to burger bars in a COVID world, but man, I loved Roy Rogers, to make it local. When I was a kid, had a burger bar, and you could get like horseradish sauce you could put on your burger and eat your fries with was fantastic. And then Fuddruckers is the place that really blew out the concept of the burger bar and having like different kinds of lettuce and different kinds of toppings and shit like that. I've got a lot of time for
they sell you the burger and then you build it kind of shit. I like that a lot.
See, so. This is why, like, and again, it's a Canadian thing, but this is why Harvey's is the best fast food burger place, because it's a fast food place and yet they build a burger in front of you, like Subway style, with all the burger toppings, and it's perfect. Right. That's
and named after Harvey Weinstein, correct? I think I saw that on Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's sure. It sounds legit, so I'll go with it.
Okay, very good. Finally, Lucas Denny wants to know which team right now has the greatest gap in quality and play on the ice to quality of jersey, i.e., the Colorado road jersey is putrid, but damn, they are an amazing team. Well, thinking about the final eight teams.
Okay, final, because I was going to say the easy answer there is the Red Wings. I mean, that's a fantastic.
You went the other way. Jersey. Fantastic jersey, shitty team.
Absolute garbage team. I mean, I'm on the record as not being a big uniform guy. But let me.
Carolina Hurricanes is always one for me. Like, Swirly Toilet Bowl logo doesn't do anything for me. I feel like they could look better. The Avalanche, I'm on the record of just saying I'm not a fan. We've seen different variations of the Avalanche jersey in outdoor games and stuff. They all look better than what they wear normally, and their logo could seriously use a refresh. I still say it looks like something out of a children's book where you're trying to learn the letter A. It's a bad logo. But of the teams that are still remaining, I mean, look. Your mileage may vary on the Lightning jersey. I think they're fine. There's something kind of retro cool about them. I know they're basically a knockoff of the Leafs at the end of the day, as far as, you know, color scheme and everything else. So if you wanted to say that the Lightning are fan-fucking-tastic on the ice and their jersey looks pretty good, I'm here for that. But his example of the Avalanche might be the ultimate one, just because I've been waiting for years for them to just officially refresh that jersey. But I mean, if you're going to go the other way, I mean, obviously Detroit's the answer.
And then the only other one I'd throw out there is the Canucks. The current look is fine, but they had such a great the black and orange and gold flying skate look is so good that just anything. It's like, you know. It's like your friend who had like the really cool girlfriend or boyfriend and it didn't work out and now they're with someone else. And you're like, that person's fine, but I miss that. Remember that other guy? He was great. Sorry.
That's good. That's good. That's all very good. I like that a lot. All right. That's the show for this week. We've gone long enough. Go buy some Mack Weldon shit. MackWeldon.com/puck. It's good stuff. You could read all my stuff on ESPN.com, including my column today on playoff officiating that also has the three players that you meet in Zoom press conferences is the comedy bit in the column this week. It's very good. You can listen to my other podcast, ESPN on Ice, with Emily Kaplan. We talked to Steve Mayer from the NHL about the bubble and next season. Oh, and if you didn't read it, do check out our story from Tuesday about next season, in which we talked to a bunch of team executives and league executives on background about what they think is going to happen, including how many games we might play, when we might get fans back in the arena, and all that shit. It was really eye-opening to do that story. And I don't often put over the work of my cohorts on this podcast unless they've done it for the Patreon. But I will go ahead and say that you should obviously read Sean and our also Puck Soup adjacent friend Sean Gentile and their rundown of American and Canadian commercials during the Stanley Cup playoffs. And Sean, did you not ever see the Idina Menzel Geico commercial?
I had never seen it. It doesn't run in Canada. And I had their... Once I had the idea for doing this piece, I, you know, intentionally avoided seeking it out on YouTube or something like that. But yeah, this is something that I don't think a lot of hockey fans realize, is that in playoff time, you're always annoyed by the same commercials playing over and over and over again, but they're for the most part, different in Canada and the U.S. So Canadians have no idea what you're talking about with the taxidermy, and Americans have no idea when we're complaining about cellies and frosted flakes. Like, it's just complete confusion. So my idea was, let's have a Canadian and an American watch each other's most annoying commercials for the first time and react to them in real time. And is it going to win a Pulitzer? Probably. It probably will. But they haven't announced it yet.
What did you find more accursed? The Idina Menzel Geico commercial or the $5 foot long? What's the third one that's always in big rotation? I'm trying to remember which one it is.
Sean's third American commercial was the David Pastrnak cold
beer. Oh, yeah, the Dunkin' commercial. Coin. Yeah. To me, it's either $5 foot long or Idina Menzel are the two choices.
Yeah, the $5 foot long wasn't awful for me, because while I had never seen that, we do have like the $5 foot long campaign in Canada, so I'd heard the jingle before. This was just an especially annoying version of something I'd seen, whereas the Idina Menzel thing was, it, like I said in the piece, it, when I actually sat down to watch for the first time, it felt like I didn't see John Wick until it had been out for a couple years, and I remember sitting down and being like, there's no way this is going to live up to the hype, and it did. And I feel like this did too, because the Terra Terra song has been in my head for now 48 hours, like on loop.
Do you mean Terra Terra, look at her go with a fresh cup of Joe?
I've taken my headphones off.
Work
I can't
early,
hear you.
Following her dreams into tax attorney. Yeah, it's an accursed commercial. It's fucking horrible. Hey,
both countries are like telling each other that their ads aren't that bad. They're like, oh, ours are way worse than yours. What are you talking about? It's because you haven't seen them 100 times. And that's the amazing thing about the Terra ad is I've seen it. I watched it once and then a second and a third time with Sean, and I haven't watched it since, and I never will. And it's still stuck in my head. Like you have to watch 100 times to really get the full effect, but. Oh, my Lord. I now get why you're all so cranky all the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's other reasons, too. I want to pause on something, though, real quick. You mentioned that you have $5 footlongs in Canada. This does not seem to square with the metric system, sir. Explain yourself.
You wouldn't think it works with the conversions either, but it's not the, like, $5 third of a meter. Yeah, we don't.
It would be 1 foot is defined as 0.3048 meters. Okay. So a quick back of the napkin using my calculator function on my computer here times. So that's 1 foot. So that's So it's zero. It would be 0.3048 long.
Correct.
Meter long. Yeah, you don't want that.
Yeah, it's a little wordy, so we just...
Where does Subway fit in the pantheon of food in Canada? Because I don't understand why you would go there if you have a Tim Hortons to grab a sandwich at.
It's pretty ubiquitous. We've got that. We've got a bunch of sub places. We've got Mr. Sub, which I think is more of a Canadian thing.
That name again is Mr. Sub?
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty creative stuff. So yeah, it's a thing. I mean, Tim Hortons, you can get a sandwich, but it takes forever, and they're not all that great. So it's.
But again, you can get a fucking donut sandwich value meal, which is again my favorite thing about Tim Hortons.
If you happen to pick the one food item that they actually have that day, like you stand in line and then you go to the front, you're like ham sandwich, and they're like no ham, and you're like. Chicken soup? They're like, nope, not today.
Nope.
It's the cheese sketch from Monty Python, except you're trying to just get some lunch, and then you just walk out there with a pack of 20 Timbits, and you're like, I guess I'm eating this for lunch today. All right.
Oh yeah, or you walk the 5 feet to the next Tim Hortons and see if they have
also
what
possible
you're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What do you have to plug, sir?
That was pretty much it.
All right.
I wrote other stuff. I got a mailbag tomorrow, but. That's the main one.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Ryan, we assume, is back next week if the Antifa plane has landed. And we go to the Patreon to listen to the mailbag.
And if you haven't, go to the Patreon and check out the Hockey Chopped episode. It's really good. Thanks, everybody, for listening and supporting the show. We will talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part 2.